62. Two sons-in-law. The public prosecutor's first wife had gone through the Civil War with him. She was a proficient machine gunner. Her life was regulated by the latest instructions from her party cell. She could never have raised the House of Makarigin to its present level of prosperity. Indeed, it is difficult to imagine how, if she had not died giving birth to Clara, she could have adjusted to the intricate twists and turns of the times. Alvetina Nikanorovna, Makarigin's present wife, on the other hand, had transformed the family's life, enriching and filling with new sap what had been a stunted and parched existence. She had no very clear conception of class distinctions, and political instruction had taken up very little of her time. What she knew for certain was that a respectable family cannot thrive without good cooking and an abundance of good quality bed and table linen, and that, as the family consolidates its position, such important outward signs of prosperity as silver, cut glass, and fine carpets must make their appearance. Alvetina Nikanorovna's great talent was for acquiring these things without great expense, never missing a good buy at closed auctions, in the private shops for employees in the procuratorial and judicial system, in commission shops, or in the flea markets of newly incorporated territories. She made special journeys to Lvov and Riga, when no one could get there without a pass, and when old ladies were only too glad to sell their heavy tablecloths and their dinner services for a song. She became a great expert on glassware. She did not collect the glass now produced by the state glass combine, warped in its passage through relays of indifferent hands, but old-fashioned crystal that somehow preserved the character of its creator and sparkled with his craftsmanship. A great deal of it had been confiscated by court order in the 20s and 30s, and sold later to a privileged few. That evening, as always, the table was beautifully laid and the food so plentiful that the two very young Bashkir maids, the Makarigin's own and another borrowed from the neighbours for the party, could hardly keep up with the rapid succession of dishes. Both girls were from the same village, Chekmagush, and had left school together the summer before. Their faces, tense and flushed from the heat of the kitchen, showed awareness of the importance of the occasion and eagerness to please. They were satisfied with their position, and hoped that not by next spring, but by the one after, they would have earned enough and bought the right clothes to find husbands in the city, instead of going back to the kolkhoz. Alvetina Nikanorovna, a fine figure of a woman whom no one would call old, watched the servants with approval. What particularly preoccupied the hostess was the last-minute change of plan. It was to have been a party for the youngsters. The only older people present were to be members of the family. Makarigin had given a banquet for his colleagues 2 days earlier, and this time had invited only the Serb Dusan Radovich, an old friend of his from the Civil War, and subsequently a professor in the long-abolished Institute of Red Professors. Apart from him, a humble girlhood friend of the prosecutor's wife, in Moscow on a shopping expedition from the rural district where her husband was a minor party official, had been allowed to attend. But then, quite unexpectedly, Major General Slavuta, also a prosecutor and a very important man in the service, had arrived back from the Far East, where he was involved in the sensational trial of the Japanese officers accused of planning bacteriological warfare, and it was impossible not to invite him. But now, in Slavuta's presence, they felt ashamed of those semi-legal guests, the prosecutor's old friend and the friend of his wife's youth, both hardly friends any more. Slavuta might think that the Makarigins entertained riffraff. This thought was complicating and poisoning Alevtina Nikanorovna's evening. She seated her old friend, who was miserable because she was married to a nitwit, as far from Slavuta as possible, and made her talk quietly and attack her food less greedily. At the same time, the hostess was gratified that her friend tried every dish, asked for recipes, and was enchanted in turn by the tableware and the guests. It was for Slavuta's sake that they had invited Innocenti so pressingly, insisting that he should come in his diplomatic uniform with the gold braid, and so, together with their other son-in-law, the celebrated writer Nikolai Galakhov, make the occasion no ordinary one. But, to his father-in-law's annoyance, the diplomat had arrived late, when supper was over, and the young people had drifted away to dance. Innocenti had reluctantly given in and put on that accursed uniform. On the way there, he had felt like a lost soul. But staying at home was just as impossible. There was nowhere he could bear to be. And yet, when he entered, sour-faced, an apartment full of people, of animated chatter, laughter, and colour, he felt that this was the one place in which he could not possibly be arrested, and quickly recovered his equilibrium, indeed felt more relaxed than usual. He eagerly drank what was poured out for him, eagerly helped himself from one dish and another. For 24 hours he had scarcely been able to swallow, but now his appetite was happily roused. His high spirits mollified his father-in-law, and made conversation easier at the distinguished end of the table, where Makarygin had been desperately manoeuvring to prevent Radovich from firing off some provocative remark, to keep Slavuta happy, and to make sure Galachov was not bored. Now, lowering his rich bass voice, he began jokingly reproving Innocenti for not gladdening his old age with grandchildren.
"What do you think of him and his wife?" he grumbled. "Here they are, a well-matched couple, a ram and a ewe. And what do? They just live for themselves. Get fat, not a care in the world. They've got it made. And they burn the candle at both ends. Ask this young dog, and he'll tell you he's an Epicurean. Am I right, Innocenti? Own up now, you're a follower of Epicurus, aren't you?"
It was impossible, even as a joke, to call a member of the All-Union Communist Party a young Hegelian, a neo-Kantian, a subjectivist, an agnostic, or, God forbid, a revisionist. But Epicurean sounded so inoffensive that it couldn't possibly affect a man's claim to be an orthodox Marxist. Radovich, who knew and cherished every detail in the biographies of the Founding Fathers, seized his opportunity to contribute.
"Well, Epicurus was a good man, a materialist. Karl Marx himself wrote a dissertation on Epicurus."
Radovich was wearing a threadbare semi-military tunic, and his skin was dark parchment stretched over a blocky head. He had never left the house without his Budeni helmet until just recently, when the militia started pulling him over. Innocenti warmed to the theme, and looked challengingly at these unsuspecting people. What a bold step it was, to intervene in a struggle between titans. At that moment he saw himself as the darling of the gods. For Makarygin, and even for Slavuta, both of whom might have aroused his contempt at any other time, he felt a sort of affection, because they were fellow men and also contributors to his present safety. Epicurus! He accepted the challenge, eyes twinkling. "Yes, I'm his follower. I don't deny it. But it may surprise you to learn that Epicurean is one of those words which are wrongly understood in common usage. When people want to say that someone has an inordinate appetite for life, is sensual, lustful, or even just a hog, they say he's an Epicurean. No, wait a minute, I'm serious about this." He cut short their protests, excitedly waving the empty, tall-stemmed wine glass he held in his thin, sensitive fingers. "In fact, Epicurus is just the opposite of our general conception of him. He most certainly does not incite us to take part in orgies. Among the three main evils that prevent men from being happy, Epicurus includes insatiable desires. You didn't know that, did you? He says that in reality man needs very little, and for that very reason his happiness is not at fate's mercy. He frees man from fear of fate's blows, and that makes Epicurus a great optimist."
"You do surprise me," Galachov said,
and took out a leather-bound notebook complete with white ivory pencil. In spite of his resounding fame, Galachov behaved like one of the boys and went in for winking and backslapping. His graying blonde hair made a picturesque contrast to his swarthy, rather fleshy features.
"Quick, give him another drink," Slavuta said to Makarygin,
pointing to Innocenti's empty glass,
"or he'll talk our heads off."
His father-in-law filled his glass, and once more Innocenti drank with enjoyment. At that moment he almost felt himself that Epicurus's philosophy was worth adopting. Slavuta, whose face was puffy but not that of an old man, treated Makarygin with a certain condescension. His promotion to colonel-general had already been approved, but was delighted to make Galachov's acquaintance. He pictured himself later that evening making another visit he had in mind, and casually announcing that an hour ago he had been having a few drinks with Kolya Galachov, who had told him. But Galachov, too, had arrived late, and for once said nothing at all. No doubt his mind was on his next novel. Concluding that there was nothing to be gotten from the celebrity, Solvuta was ready to leave. Makarigan, however, urged him to stay a bit longer, and persuaded him that they must worship at the altar of tobacco, by which he meant the collection he kept in his study. He himself smoked Bulgarian pipe tobacco, which he got through a friend, and made do with cigars in the evening. But he liked to impress his guests by regaling them with different blends in turn. The door to his study was right behind them. Their host opened it and invited Slavuta and his sons-in-law to step inside. The sons-in-law, however, made excuses and left the older men to their own company. Makarigin, more afraid than ever that Dushan would let his tongue run away with him, stood aside to let Slavuta enter and wagged a warning finger at the Serb in the doorway. The brothers-in-law were left by themselves at the deserted end of the table. They were at that happy age, Galachov was the older by a few years, at which, though still considered young, they were no longer dragged off to dance, and they could indulge in men's talk among the half-empty bottles to the accompaniment of music somewhere in the background. A week ago, in fact, Galachov had conceived the idea of writing about the imperialist conspiracy and the struggle of Soviet diplomats for peace, not a novel this time, but a play, which would make it easier for him to avoid all the unfamiliar details of locale and dress. This was an excellent opportunity to interview his brother-in-law, simultaneously noting the characteristics of a typical Soviet diplomat and extracting detailed information about life in the West, where the whole action of the play was to take place, but where Galachov himself had been only very briefly, at one of the progressive congresses. Galachov realized that it wasn't quite the thing to be writing about a way of life of which you knew nothing, but in recent years he had found that life abroad or some hoary historical theme or even fantasy about the inhabitants of the moon yielded more easily to his pen than the real life all around him, where every path lay through a minefield of taboos. The servants were rattling tea-things. The hostess looked about her and, with Slavuta out of the way, no longer tried to keep her old friend's voice down, as she insisted that even in the Zarechensky rayon there were good medical facilities, good doctors, and that the children of party activists were separated from the rest in early infancy, and assured of an uninterrupted supply of milk and unstinted penicillin injections. Music reached them from a record player in the next room, and the metallic boom of a television set from the room beyond. Bright-eyed and confident after his triumphant defense of Epicurus, Innocenti assented. It's the privilege of writers to interrogate, like investigating officers, endlessly questioning people about their crimes. What we look for in a man is not his crimes but his virtues, his positive characteristics. Then the demands of your work are at odds with those of your conscience. You say you want to write a book about diplomats. Galachov smiled. Say what you like, Ink. These things need more thought than a New Year interview. You need to stock up with material in advance, and you can't start questioning just any diplomat. It's my good luck we're related. And your choice shows how perceptive you are. A diplomat who wasn't a relative would tell you a load of nonsense. There are things we need to hide, you know. They looked into each other's eyes. I realize that. But I won't be trying to show that side of your work. I'm not, aha! What mainly interests you, then, is embassy life, our daily routine, what goes on at receptions, the presentation of credentials, and all that. No, I want to go deeper than that. I want to show how certain things are refracted in the minds of Soviet diplomats. Refracted, eh? Right, I've got it. And I'll tell you all about it before the evening's out, but you tell me something first. What about the war? Have you given up writing about it? Have you exhausted the subject? Galachov shook his head. It can never be exhausted. Yes, that war was your good luck. Where else would you have found your conflicts and tragedies? Innocenti was still smiling. The writer's brow clouded over. The war theme, he said, is engraved on my heart. And you've created masterpieces in that genre.
and I dare say it will be with me forever. I will keep returning to it as long as I live.
Perhaps it would be better not to.
I must, because the war stirs noble emotions in men's souls.
It does, I agree. But what does all this war literature come down to? How to take up battle stations, how to carry out a saturation bombardment.
We'll never forget, never forgive. An officer's command is law to his subordinates.
But all that is much better put in army regulations.
Oh, yes, and you also show what difficulty the wretched officers have in locating anything on a map.
Dalakhov frowned. Commanding officers were his favourite military characters.
Are you talking about my last novel?
Of course not, Nikolai. But do works of imagination really have to reproduce army regulations, or newspaper articles, or slogans?
Mayakovsky, for one, took pride in using an excerpt from a newspaper as the epigraph to a poem. In other words, he prided himself on not rising above the level of a newspaper. If that's how you think, what's the point of literature? After all, a writer exists to teach other people. Isn't that what was always expected of him?
The brothers-in-law met infrequently and did not know each other well.
What you say is true only under bourgeois regimes,
Dalakhov replied cautiously.
Innocenti wasn't going to argue with that.
Of course, of course. Our laws are different. I didn't mean to...
He made a circular movement with his hand.
Please believe me, Kolya. I really like you, and that's why I particularly want to ask you, while I'm in the mood, as one of the family. Have you ever asked yourself, how do you see your place in Russian literature? I mean, you've written enough for a 6-volume collected works. You're 37. They'd already bumped Pushkin off at your age. You're not in danger of that. Still, you can't evade the question, who are you? Is this tormented age any the richer for your ideas? Apart, of course, from the incontrovertible ideas you yourself owe to socialist realism.
Innocenti abandoned sarcasm and asked his next question as though it hurt.
Tell me, Kolya, don't you sometimes feel ashamed of our generation?
Small furrows came and went on Galakhov's brow, and he sucked his cheeks in. You're touching me on a sensitive spot, he answered, staring at the tablecloth. What Russian writer hasn't secretly tried on Pushkin's frock coat or Tolstoy's blouse?
He turned his pencil this way and that on the tablecloth and looked at Innocenti with eyes that had nothing to hide. He, too, felt an urge to speak out, to say things that couldn't be said with other writers present.
When I was a kid, at the beginning of the 5-year plans, I thought I would die happy if I could just see my name in print over a poem. I imagined that would be the beginning of immortality, but then...
Dutnara advanced on them, avoiding empty chairs or pushing them out of her way.
Inni, Kolya, you won't shoo me off, will you? Are you talking about something too clever for me?
She couldn't have chosen a worse moment. As she came toward them, the very sight of her, the thought that she was an inescapable part of his life, suddenly brought home to Innocenti the dreadful truth. He remembered what awaited him. The party and the humorous exchanges at table ceased to exist. His heart sank. His throat was hot and dry. Meanwhile, Dottie stood waiting for an answer, toying with the edges of her raglan blouse. Her fair hair fell loosely over her narrow fur collar. She knew how to make the best of herself, and had ignored 9 years of changing hairstyles. She was flushed, or was it the cherry-red blouse that made her look like that? And there was that doe-like tremor of the upper lip that he knew and loved. It happened when someone paid her a compliment or obviously found her attractive. But why just now? She had been trying for so long to emphasize how independent of him she was, how different her view of life was from his. Why this sudden change? A presentiment that they were to part? Why was she suddenly so meek and affectionate? Why that doe-like twitch of the lip? Innocenti could never forgive her, and had not even asked himself whether he could forgive her for the long spell of incomprehension, estrangement, and unfaithfulness. He knew that she, too, could not change all at once. But this meekness of hers warmed his cramped heart. He took her hand and drew her onto a chair beside him, something that would have been impossible between them all through the autumn. Dotty submitted gracefully, sat down beside her husband, and clung to him, not indecorously close, but close enough for all to see how much she loved him and how happy she was to be with him. It occurred to Innocenti briefly, with Dotty's future in mind, that it would be better for her not to make this show of an intimacy that did not really exist. But he gently stroked her arm in the cherry-red sleeve. The writer's white ivory pencil lay idle. Leaning on the table, Kolakov stared past husband and wife at the big window, which was lit by the streetlights at the Kaluga gate. He could not talk frankly about himself with women around, nor, perhaps, without them. But nowadays his poems, however long, appeared in print. Hundreds of theatres throughout the country put on his plays after their run in Moscow. Girls copied out his verses and learned them by heart. The central press had happily put its pages at his disposal during the war. He had tried his hand at the feuilleton, the long, short story, Criticism. And finally his novel had appeared. He had won one Stalin Prize, then another, and yet another. And where had it gotten him? Strangely, he had won fame, but not immortality. He himself had not noticed when and how he had overburdened the bird of immortality and crippled its flight. Perhaps it had taken wing only in those few lines that schoolgirls memorized. As for the plays, the stories, the novel, they had died on him before he had reached the age of 37. But why should anyone strive for immortality? Most of Golakov's fellow writers had no thought of immortality. What mattered to them was their position in their own lifetime. To hell with immortality, they said. Surely it's more important to influence the course of events here and now. And influence it they did. Their books served the people. They were published in print runs of hundreds of thousands. Government subsidies assured their dissemination to libraries everywhere, and special book promotion months were organized for them. Of course, much that was true could not be written about. But they consoled themselves with the thought that circumstances would change some day, and they would return to the same events, show them in a different and truer light, publish amended versions of their old books. Meanwhile, the thing to do was to write at least that quarter, that eighth, that sixteenth, or, yes, damn it, that 1/32nd part of the truth which was permitted. Write about love and kisses and the beauties of nature, if you like. Any little thing was better than nothing. But Golakov was oppressed by a feeling that every decent page was harder to write than the last one. He forced himself to work to a timetable, struggled against his yawning fits, his mental sluggishness, his wandering thoughts, his habit of listening for the mailman and breaking off to look at the newspapers. He saw to it that his study was aired, that the room temperature was 18 degrees centigrade, that his desk was clean and polished. Otherwise, he could not write. Whenever he started on a new, large work, he was full of fire and swore to himself and his friends that this time he would make no concessions, that he would write a real book. He sat down enthusiastically to write the first pages. But he soon began to notice that he was not alone, that an image floated up and hovered ever more distinctly before him, the image of the one for whom he was writing, and with whose eyes he willy-nilly re-read each newly written paragraph. And this one was not the reader, his brother, friend, and contemporary. Nor was he a generalized critic, but for some reason always the illustrious critic-in-chief, Yermilov. Golakov could not help imagining Yermilov reading this new work with his chin flattened against his chest, preparing to open fire on it with an enormous, it had happened before, full-page article in Literary Gazette. He would give it some such title as Unwholesome Trends, or Another Look at Certain Fashionable Tendencies on Our Tried and Tested Path. He would not get straight to the point, but would begin with some sacrosanct statement by Belinsky or Nekrasov, with which only a villain could fail to agree. Then he would carefully twist these words, turn them around till they meant something quite different, and Belinsky or Herzen would be seen passionately attesting that Golakov's new book showed him to be an antisocial, anti-human figure with shaky philosophical foundations. Trying paragraph after paragraph to anticipate Yermilov's objections, and adjust himself to them. Golakov soon weakened in his efforts to express himself fully. Of its own accord, the book spinelessly curled up and collapsed. When he was already halfway through, Golakov saw that a different book had been foisted on him, and he had another failure on his hands.
"Oh, yes, you were asking what Soviet diplomats are like,"
Innocenti resumed where he had left off.
But his voice was hollow, and he wore a wry smile. "You can easily imagine them for yourself. Firm ideological convictions, high principles, total dedication to the cause, profound personal devotion to Comrade Stalin, unswerving adherence to instructions from Moscow. Some have a very good, others a poor knowledge of foreign languages. And then, of course, their great enthusiasm for the pleasures of the flesh. Because, as the saying goes, we only live once."